The following teaching is part 16 in a 20-part series by Dr. Ken Boa titled, Answering the Tough Questions About Life and God.
We're going to be looking at question number 8. If Christianity is true, why are there so many hypocrites? One of the 12 common objections, and you'll hear all sorts of variations of it. Too many Christians I know are phonies. If that's what Christianity is all about, why should I become one? Or if Christians are really concerned about others, why don't they show it? Or another variation might be something like this, since some non-Christians I know seem to live better lives than Christians that I know. So how do you account for that? Doesn't that show that Christianity isn't all that it claims to be? Have you heard that objection before? I often run into that. And there's a lot of truth to that. There are many atheists who seem to be better adjusted people than some believers I know. And that's just an issue we have to talk about. As well, some people would say, how can people who profess to be Christians still be full of racial hatred, materialism, and social insensitivity, or any other number of things that might surface? Or many churchgoers seem to have real holier-than-thou attitudes, you know, the self-righteous. Why should I join the ranks of the self-righteous? And the assumption, of course, is that all Christians are kind of painted with a broad brush. They're all that way. They're all this way. And many people's association with Christianity has to do with the electric church. It has to do with media. It has to do with television, especially. A lot of people, that's their only encounter. I'll be perfectly frank with you. If that were my only encounter, I rather doubt that I'd be interested in the faith. There are a few good people, but for every one, there seems to be quite a handful of folks who are kind of, well, let's just say that it's not maybe the best representation of the faith. And I wonder what Jesus would really think about this kind of incarnation of the faith that is often distorted into just a litany of attempts to manipulate money out of the audience, that sort of approach. And so one gets very real sensitive to that. Many times I get a lot of junk mail from Christian organizations. And it's the same sort of junk mail you get from secular organizations, you know, and it's the same techniques they use and so forth, always asking for money and so forth, pleading. It's always a crisis, always an emergency, this, that, and the other. You have to bail us out. And those sorts of things can be somewhat embarrassing as well. How do we deal with this kind of a question? I mean, does this sort of problem, which really does exist, does that really invalidate the claims of Christianity? And clearly you'll know that I'm going to be arguing that it does not. But we still have to think it through and see how we can understand these issues together. So first option on your sheet is that hypocrisy invalidates Christianity. The assumption here is that it's going to be something that really does kill it. And I'm going to be arguing against that. But first of all, I would say it is a problem in the Christian church. But this doesn't mean that all Christians are hypocrites. I want to suggest, first of all, that wherever the Christian church has spread, there have been incalculable benefits that have gone with it. Benefits that are on the spiritual area, social benefits, intellectual benefits, and physical benefits. I think of hospitals. I think of orphanages, of schools, of organizations for social justice that are done in the name of Christ. I think about William Wilberforce and his whole life spent for the abolition of slavery, for example, in 19th century England. I think about the Wesleys and the powerful impact that they had, the various revivals, the Great Awakenings, that had powerful impacts on their culture. The Welsh Revival and how it had more than just a spiritual but a cultural sort of rejuvenation that took place. Wherever we go, you see these sorts of things spreading as well. Overcoming ignorance, disease, and all those sorts of things. But what do people always think about instead? Rather than think about the myriad of examples of these things, what do we often instead run into? It's usually three particular things that people always bring to mind. It's almost always the same three issues that surface. Things that were done in the name of Jesus, but that were clearly problematic. Can you think of those three?
Crusades.
The Crusades are always the first one. The Inquisition's always up there. And what's the third one? Come on, you can think about it. The Salem witch trials, they always come up with that. Come on, you know better than that. These are the three that they'll always come up with. And then if they're real creative, they'll think of some other things. But often, that exhausts their history. And then they move on to televangelists. And they'll talk about, well, look at this guy here. He was caught doing this, and he's back on TV again. Or you see how that goes? So then they get, that's their current knowledge. And so the assumption is the whole thing is just hogwash. It just doesn't ring true. It's not true at all. Well, what we can certainly say is that, yes, there have been some genuine atrocities that have been done in the name of Christianity, some things that have genuinely been wrong. But the thing that we want to do is to examine what that all implies for the Christian faith. So the first thing I'll do is, when I hear this question, I'll say, you know, you're right. There is a lot of hypocrisy that you run into. And it would be foolish to deny that has been the case. These were maybe done in the name of Christianity, but actually they were techniques designed to acquire wealth, power, land, and so forth. And many of these wars that we run into, for example, in Ireland, that are done in the name of religion, really have very much less to do with religion than we might suppose, and much more to do with all sorts of other issues that surface as well. So you have a lot of things done in the name of that, but really are not necessarily done for the right reasons, of course. In fact, it was Blaise Pascal who put it so well. He said, men never do evil so completely and so cheerfully as when they do it out of religious conviction. Stop and think about it. Suppose you're convinced, as they put it in the Crusades, they used to say this. You may sometimes see this, Deus vult, which means God wills it. That was the phrase that was on the lips of many of the Crusaders. God wills it, therefore we got to go, you see? And after all, too, on some of the Crusades, people who went were promised a plenary indulgence, which is a pretty powerful pull. You know what a plenary indulgence is? Plenary indulgence is this. You don't spend any time in purgatory. You get off scot-free. And as you do this, and you're a guarantee for heaven, going straight in. But you don't go to jail. Instead, you go straight in. You see the idea? So, you know, if you bought into that, if you were convinced of that, you would be a really ardent crusader, if you really think about that notion. And so I'm saying here that there are all sorts of ways in which people who can convince themselves that they are really doing God's will, if they're not doing the right thing, that they don't have any pangs of conscience because they've convinced themselves. That's why they can do it so cheerfully and completely, because it's been done in the name of religious conviction. That's a frightening sort of thing. And so I will first of all say, yes, There are many sources of hypocrisy, and that there are many forms of hypocrisy. Let's just look at a few. What are some of the kinds of hypocrisy that we observe? Well, let's take a look at, for example, even the area of church membership. Why do people join? Now, obviously, you and I cannot evaluate everybody's motives and their motivational structure, but it's certainly fair to say that a lot of people can join churches for the wrong reasons. What would be some of those reasons? Political, social, economic. Being seen in the right church can really help your business. A little networking, you know, and it doesn't hurt. That sort of thing. It's the thing to do. You look good. That sort of thing. So if a person goes to church for those sorts of reasons, then we have a problem, do we not, of appearing or posturing to be one thing, but really one is perhaps another. Then there's another problem, and there's a facade that takes place. A facade of spirituality that can often occur, where people want to present themselves as being far, far more spiritual. They're afraid that their Christian friends would not accept them if they really knew what they were like. So everything's just great. I've seen this happen before. The mom and dad have just had an argument on the way to church because he was telling her or she was telling him, how come you're never ready on time? So they're driving to church, and then the kids start fighting in the back seat. So there's a total brawl going on. They pull up to the church parking lot. As soon as they get out, all of a sudden, all sweetness and smiles, you know? And somebody asks them, they've just been furious, bent out of shape, and someone asks them, oh, how are you doing today? Oh, the Lord is good. It's just a wonderful thing. We're just really being blessed, yeah. And people after a while buy into that deal as if it's perfectly acceptable to be posed as one person here, but in another sense, you know that's not true, but you're terrified that people will see what you're really like and then you won't be accepted. Or the idea of impressing people or trying to earn their acceptance. There are sorts of things like that that can take place there. Another kind of form of this is where we're so concerned. And by the way, I'm very big on thinking right, but the danger here is that there are some people who can be so focused on orthodox doctrine about God, Christ, the Holy Spirit, and the Bible that they have a greater passion for the doctrine than for the objects, that is to say, for the person of Christ. You see the idea, that a real possibility? So there can be a dead orthodoxy. There are places where you can go where folks may have their act together biblically, but there seems to be no love, no compassion, no grace, no mercy extended. And that can easily occur as well. That can seem to be one impression here, and yet another reality is over there, which is what we'll see hypocrisy really exposes. Or it's very possible for ministers who somehow feel that they don't want to convey the impression that they're different than what they preach. That is to say, they want to convey the impression that they live up to their sermons. I want to tell you, nobody lives up to their sermons, and it's a better thing when you admit that you don't. It's a good thing. People are very relieved when a minister is vulnerable and admit that they struggle like everybody else. But when you have this mindset somehow that you can't admit vulnerability, weakness, temptation, difficulties, there's a lack of reality and authenticity that sets in. And when that occurs, a person begins to habituate that kind of posturing. And they become inauthentic people because what you see is not what they really are. And that after a while can become a habit. Or another form of hypocrisy can be the issue of commitments. And these commitments, promises we make, vows we say, commitments we make at work or other things, when we break those kinds of commitments, then there can be, again, the illusion that we claim to do this, but our practice belies us. We see a different kind of person than what the person claimed to be. So all these things are problems. But you can see where I'm going with this. While that may be true, for every example that we can come up with of here, I can give you many counterexamples of people who really have a genuine faith and a genuine transformation in their lives. And those can be multiplied. It would be almost like throwing out the whole medical profession, as I heard one fellow do the other day. I happened to be visiting a friend in a hospital, and this guy had it in for doctors, and he basically said that 99% of the doctors are quacks, and most of the other other percent are crooks. So they're either quacks or crooks. Well, come on, give me a break here. There are indeed a lot of inept physicians, and some who are indeed guilty of malpractice and so forth, but For every one that we really nail in that area, we're going to find that the whole practice, the whole profession is not characterized like this. It would be silly to have this idea that those few are going to then be representative of the entire thing. And, you know, I have a lawyer's forum at Alston and Byrd where a number of attorneys come from different firms. One thing that people who come to my lawyer's forum know that I never crack a lawyer joke. It's not my place to do that. And I find that sometimes people really, they get a little bit too harsh and almost downright nasty about the legal profession. And indeed, there are some good examples one can use of that. But let's not be so silly as to say a Christian lawyer is an oxymoron. let's not go that far. So what we see here is that, yes, I admit it's an issue. There are all sorts of ways people can be hypocritical, but they can do that without having to be religious, too. There are thousands of ways we can do that in all walks of life. So let's back off and get some perspective. First of all, why don't we define our term? What does hypocrisy mean? So our first point that I'm making here is that it is a problem in the Christian church and that there are sources and forms. But let's see what hypocrisy is. As I say, it's the pretense of being what one is not. And I want to suggest then that this is a very important understanding. The word, there are different ways of transliterating it. Hypocrisis is a word that was a word that came to mean pretense. it came to mean outward show. But there's another, hupokrites, is another one, and when it's like that, it's a word that was used of those masks. Have you seen playbills where they have the smile and then they have the frown like that? And Greek actors actually would hold these up or put them on their face and speak through that. So they would actually, that would symbolize the character. So they would, clearly you have a tragic figure, they would always look like this. And so that's when we've come to see them and associate them then with drama, with comedy, and with tragedy. And the idea that it was a mask that they put on, and the word then came to be used then, of course, of a person who was pretending to be something that he or she was not. You see how that could come to pass. That's not the real person, that's the image, the persona that I'm projecting. So the hypocrite then, according to this understanding, is living a lie, because such a person makes a pretense of moral character that person does not possess. What the person carefully covers up one's faults to make sure that nobody else will really observe and that others will have a higher opinion of them. And so for a person to come to Christ on Christ's terms then, you'd actually have to become just the exact opposite of a hypocrite. Let me explain why. Because you see, for a person to come to Jesus, what must one do? First of all, the first thing you have to do is you have to admit you got a problem. And if you do not admit this, you're pretending to be something you're not. I did not come to call the righteous. Do you recall him saying this? But sinners. I came then to call people who admit their sin. I'd like you to look with me in John chapter 9. In John 9, you have this marvelous story about the healing of the man who was born blind. And we won't go into the story itself. But you recall, at the end of the account, that they put him out of the synagogue because he was a living illustration of that which they were trying to avoid, namely the messianic claims of Jesus Christ, because nobody had ever been known to heal a person who was born blind. Remember, they brought the parents, and they wanted the parents to lie and say this wasn't their child. They wanted the man to say that Jesus was a sinner and that God did it, but couldn't have been Jesus. And of course, he denied all that. So when Jesus heard that they'd put him out after he had healed them, of course, Jesus heard that they'd put him out, and finding him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" Because he wasn't clear. Jesus said to him, and it's most appropriate, you have both seen him. You catch that terminology there, because up till that day, he had not seen anybody. But he now says, you've both seen him, and he is the one who is talking with you. You knew my voice before you saw me, but now you see me and hear me. And he said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshipped him. By the way, this is an indirect claim of deity, because no one should allow one themselves to be worshipped if one is not God. Remember the angels? There are occasions when people try to worship the angels. They would say, "Do not do that. I am only a servant of God. Worship God only." And Jesus said at this point, "For judgment I came into the world." I'm in verse 39. "So that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind." Now that's a powerful phrase that you need to listen to carefully. That those who do not see may see. That is to say, people, now he's using blindness in a spiritual way. And I think I told you about this wonderful movie I saw that does the same thing. Didn't I tell you about The Color of Paradise? Fabulous film. I'm afraid it's probably gone now. And it may be still here in the plaza, I'm not sure. Best film I've seen in about a year and a half, so I strongly recommend it. It's an Iranian movie. So you have to deal with subtitles, but after a while you forget you're reading them. About a boy who is blind, and in fact it's not an actor, he really is blind, and the whole thing is a story about physical blindness versus moral and spiritual blindness. It's a very perceptive and powerful and absolutely beautiful film, which I would strongly recommend you're seeing if you have an opportunity. It's a very gripping and touching film as well. It makes me think of this, because what you're doing there is you're playing off on that theme. Blindness now becomes a metaphor for something beyond that, more powerful, as John typically does. In John, he often takes something physical and uses that as a sign that points beyond itself to the spiritual, so he does here. So he says that those who admit that they do not see may see, and that those who may see may become blind. Those who claim to see, now they become blind. Those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said to him, "We are not blind too, are we?" Because they're sharp enough to figure out what he's trying to say. Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say we see. Your sin remains." That's a very powerful moment in John's narrative. Because you claim that you see, because you claim that you have spiritual sight, your sin remains. Only when a person admits their desperate condition will they be in a position to receive the grace of God. Because grace is just that, unmerited. You don't deserve it, you don't earn it, you can't achieve it, you can't merit God's favor or approval, so stop trying. That's religion at its worst. Instead, we discover in Scripture that the Scriptures talk about a relationship, not earned or achieved, but given to us by the lover of our souls who seeks us out before we seek him. He's the one who initiates. He's the one who woos us to himself. But we can resist and we can stay in our blindness. But when we receive the grace of God, then we realize that we are, in fact, people who know what we have been and what we are without his grace. And so it's the opposite of hypocrisy. It's to admit that. I think that that's a strong word. And that's why I see also in 1 John chapter 1, verse 8. It says here that if we say we have no sin, we're deceiving ourselves and the truth is not in us. If we say that we have not sinned, we make him a liar and his word is not in us. So we must be realistic about this whole issue of sin. Now that brings me then, let's move on to our next point. So where I am then is I'm saying that people must admit their sinfulness, not cover it up. It's the opposite of hypocrisy. Now we go on to a next point. And there are three false assumptions that we can run into. One is this. Many people profess to be Christians, but profession does not mean possession. Let me develop that just a little bit for you. That is to say, just because a person professes to be a Christian or a follower of Christ, that does not mean that that individual really is. It can be a great deal of difference. There are many people who are members of church who still don't know Jesus. John Wesley was one that I just alluded to before. He wrote a booklet later on called Religion Without Christ, because he became a missionary to the American Indians and discovered that he himself didn't know Jesus. It was an interesting thing. So he said, "I came to convert the Indians. Who's going to convert me?" So if you know his marvelous story, he realizes, "I was into religion big time, but I had no I didn't know who Jesus was." Very easy to occur. Many people can go to church for decades and know about Jesus, but they haven't trusted in him. They haven't come to know him as a person. So being religious is not synonymous with having a relationship. The Pharisees were really religious people. But if you look at what Jesus had to say, it was evident that many of them didn't seem to have a relationship with God. And I would say that this is an important issue because, you see, anything that's good can be counterfeited. What are the things we counterfeit?
Money.
Besides money. That's the first thing that comes to your mind. What else do we counterfeit? Art. Art is commonly counterfeited. What else do we counterfeit?
Jewelry.
Yeah. And so, in fact, the De Beers Diamond Company is having a greater and greater problem with some increasingly deceptive artificial diamonds because the technology is getting so sophisticated that even most jewelers can't tell the difference with these new forms, some of them being made in Russia and so forth. Now they've got a point where they're micro-printing the beers on the thing in a special way that it's very difficult to imitate, just to make sure you know it's the real thing. Because why? Because if you can counterfeit it and convince, pull it off, obviously, it's going to be worth something. So anything that's of value can and will be counterfeited, but that doesn't mean that the thing is no longer has value. It doesn't mean that you get rid of money or art or jewelry because they're being counterfeited. It just means you need to distinguish between the real and the false. And that's what Proverbs is all about and what wisdom's all about. It's the ability to discern, to have the ability to perceive what's the difference between not only the good and the evil, but this is more subtle, the difference between the good and the best. It's a very difficult thing to discern that. It requires moral acumen and skill and perception and discernment. And this is a growth process. That's what Proverbs is all about. My point here, then, is that that can be a mistake. Just because something can be counterfeited, and there are many, many misdeeds done in the name of Christianity that aren't the real deal, it doesn't mean Christianity itself, the real thing, is false. In fact, I submit to you that the spirit of the Inquisition, of the Crusades, and of the Salem witch trial, the spirit behind those kinds of things is actually inimical to the teachings of Jesus Christ. It doesn't fit. It's actually contrary to his teaching in terms of the grace. The claim that was used, they actually used a verse to justify some of the Crusades. They said, if they do not come to my table, then compel them to come in. So the idea of compellarum, to compel them to come to my table. Sorry, you're going to hate me. I'm going to club you into the kingdom. You're going to hate me now, but you'll love me later. Is not exactly the best application of that text. Now we move on to another false assumption. Another false assumption is that Christians claim to be perfect. Yeah, there can be some holier-than-thou types, but I'm saying Christians don't claim to be perfect. There's a progression in the Christian life, not perfection. Yeah, it is true that there are some folks who kind of get this one mixed up. I've actually heard about a fellow who was so holier-than-thou in his mindset. And it's really, you know, there's some people who are so moralistic, and the self-righteousness just exudes from them, it seems. This fun fellow got a trophy by his co-workers, and it said, holier than thou. That was on the trophy. And the scary thing is he put it in his desk. He thought it was a compliment. So there's something wrong here. The guy has a break from reality here. So he's taking this as being a good thing. And I'm suggesting here that what often happens is that there's a bit of a double standard going on. On the one hand, there are some non-Christians who would expect a person who claims to be a Christian to exhibit performance and character and behavior that they themselves would never dream of manifesting. And when they don't, of course, they jump all over for them. But if they do act in an exemplary manner, they get mad at them and they think that they're being hypocritical and self-righteous. You can't win. So if you don't exhibit that behavior, you lose. And if you do exhibit that behavior, you're self-righteous. You see how that works? Is it possible to be moral without being moralistic? I say it is. There are some people who can manifest this by a sense of grace and a sense of humility. And that perspective of humility, by the way, the key to humility is not focusing on your own deficiency. I would submit to you, and I agree with Andrew Murray's book by that same name, Humility. His argument, and I think he's right, is that the key to humility is focusing on grace. If you focus on the grace of God, you'll have a proper self-understanding. But if you focus on yourself, the danger is there's all sorts of backhanded ways of being humble and proud of it. There are ways in which a person can be so self-deprecating, almost like the Uriah Heep mindset, I'm a very humble man. And actually it's a backwards, perverse form of pride. But actually the key to humility is to focus and center on the grace of Jesus Christ. And then you'll see everything in its proper perspective. You get your eyes off yourself and you're focusing on Him. So I do believe that Christians don't claim to be sinless, at least most don't. I've run into two that did. Their particular theology demanded that they never sin because their particular theology was so works-oriented that they felt that if they did sin, they lost their salvation. And so they could never, they had to have this cognitive break between the reality of their lives and their theology. It was really a very strange sort of a thing. But normally, as a normal thing, you don't really run into too many Christians who claim to be totally sinlessly perfect. It's very clear from many passages, Romans 7:14-25, Galatians 5:13-26, that, and other passages, that we are not perfect, but we are in a process. And we still have this struggle between this flesh and the spirit. The flesh being not the body, but rather a term that's used for a power of sin in our members that could make us vulnerable to the threefold temptations of the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life. We're always going to be susceptible to that pull. No matter where you are in your journey, there's always going to be that pull. Just as Jesus was tempted in those three arenas, you can be sure you will be tempted in varying ways by money, sex, and power in its myriad combinations and subtle combinations. So the fact is that we are on a journey and we will fail. There'll be times when we do stumble. But this doesn't invalidate Christianity. It means that for a time, at that point, we were withdrawing from our walk with Jesus and not walking by the power of His Spirit. And so the real issue here is not perfection, but progression. It's a better way of looking at it. And that's why I claim it's never a good idea to compare with other people. Don't compare where you are in your journey with someone else. It's a real mistake to do that. Better to compare where you've been and where you are yourself now in your journey, rather than to look at other people. For example, suppose you run into somebody on the beach with an average physique, and they're boasting about this fabulous exercise program that's worked so well for them. You look at them, I don't see anything particularly unusual about them, but then you find out 6 weeks before they were the quintessential 97-pound weakling. Now you maybe reevaluate their exercise program because in 6 weeks they've come to look at least normal, not totally scrawny and emaciated. So it's relative to where they were, you see. And so you can immediately see that there are some people who just are naturally nicer folks and who just are easier to get along with. I have some relatives, for example, one in particular I think about. Nothing. I've never seen the guy get angry at anything. He can be in situations where I'd be wanting to pull my hair out, especially mechanical things. I hate it when things are recalcitrant. Because what I do, I know what I do, I attribute intelligence to these inanimate objects. These things, they know what they're doing, and they do it, and then they conspired against me, and they all went wrong at once. So I'm attributing intentionality to these things. So I get all furious and bent out of shape because of that. My uncle doesn't do this. He understands that this is the way things are, and if the bolt won't undo, then there's other ways you go about it. He never gets flustered. Now, I'm not sure if this particular uncle of mine, I'm not sure where he is on the spiritual side, but I will say this, that from that point, part of his personality, he'd be seemingly more mature spiritually, wouldn't he? He would seem to have more of the fruit of the Spirit when actually it's a natural endowment that he's got. I would submit to you, wherever he was, so if he wasn't a Christian, and if he became a follower of Jesus after some years, I would expect that he had continued to move from where he was in that. But there would be other areas in his life that would need to be picked up. We all are an interesting mix. So that there are some people who, because of their upbringing, their background, all sorts of conditions, they may, in fact, be naturally more attractive, nicer folks. But it just means that their flesh is better adjusted. But it does not mean, by the way, that they're more pleasing to God. It just means they have better adjusted flesh. But no one in the flesh can be pleasing to God. Romans 8 makes it clear that unless you have the Spirit of God, even your best acts are tainted. So that none of our works, in and of themselves, are acceptable unless God reaches down and brings us into that new life. So I would say then that some non-believers are better adjusted people than some believers, but it doesn't mean Christianity is ineffective. But I would say this, even if we looked at a person and we say, I haven't seen much of a change in him, if you really look carefully at a person, you probably will see a person who really has come to know Christ. If you look carefully, you'll see some changes in their life. Typically, this is what you'll see. It's always interesting to me, too, when people say, you know, that either, A, there's no such thing as an absolute morality, or these people are all hypocrites, these Christians, and so forth. I submit to you, if that individual happened to be going down a dark street and saw a gang of youths coming toward them, they would think one thing, but then if they saw something in their hands, Bibles, what do you suppose they'd do at that point? Suddenly they'd be, I don't care if the guy is a rabid atheist and hates Christians, I promise you, his attitude toward those youths would be very, very different. He'd feel a good deal more comfortable because they're toting Bibles and going to a Bible study. You see where I'm going here. There is some genuine evidence, some genuine difference. And even though the Spirit of God indwells believers and empowers us, it's all too easy for us to quench the Spirit. Hebrews chapter 12 talks a lot about this. When a true Christian fails to progress, something will take place. That inconsistency will bring the discipline of a loving father. If a person really does know Jesus, they won't get away with it for long. They'll become miserable. In fact, increasingly miserable. Because God does love His children, He disciplines us, Hebrews 12:10. He disciplines us for our good that we may share His holiness, and ultimately so we can have the peaceable fruit of righteousness. So, If you are a real follower, if a person's a real follower of Christ, you can only get away with so much hypocrisy until you become a miserable person. In fact, if you really know Jesus, you will discover that you cannot sin for long with impunity. You'll discover, in fact, as I've often put it, that you feel that you're worse than you were before you came to know Jesus. That's a sign that you really may have the real thing. Because now you become aware and you begin to see human nature in a clearer way, and you see in a growing sense the reality of God's grace, which reaches down and gives us dignity, but it humbles us, but it also elevates us, and that there's that wonderful balance. So that's the second of my assumptions that we need to talk about. The first one is that profession equals possession. We said that that's not the case. Secondly, we said that it's progression, not perfection. Progression's the key, not perfection. We don't claim to be perfect, but we do claim to be perfectly forgiven. There's a big difference. The third idea is that all sin's hypocrisy. And I'm saying that while all Christians sin, not all Christians are hypocrites. That sin is the generic term. Hypocrisy is a species of sin. For example, to steal, to lie, those kinds of things, slander. Those are particular species of sin. But it does not mean, therefore, that all Christians are hypocrites, because that's just one category or aspect of sin. But let me suggest this, that Christ's view of hypocrisy is very, very important to take into account in this question. When we think about hypocrisy, the thing that, and this, if you remember nothing else about tonight, remember this, that when the person raises this question, my job is to convince them that they're agreeing with Jesus and the Bible. You see, you're on his side. This is a very important thing for you to understand. When you hate hypocrisy, you're simply agreeing with Jesus, because he hated it more than anything else. He reserved his harshest words for hypocrites. Matthew 23, when he's talking about the scribes and the Pharisees and their religious pretense to impress people. Frightening series of woes delivered by him to them. And it's important for us to see this. He said, "You are like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful, but inside they're full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you too outwardly appear righteous to men, but inwardly you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness." Those are very strong words. So Jesus hated hypocrisy, and so indeed does the rest of the Bible. If you turned, for example, to Isaiah, and Isaiah's words in Isaiah 29:13, let me read this for you. "This people draw near with their words. They honor me with their lip service, but they remove their hearts far from me. Their reverence for me consists of tradition learned by rote." God's not impressed by ritual without reality. He's not impressed by a bunch of actions, but that are done by people whose heart is not even near him. They're just doing them to appear spiritual, or whatever the reasons are. The scriptures are very strong on this. Amos 5, verses 21 to 24. I reject your festivals, nor do I delight in your solemn assemblies. Speaking to the prophet, he says, "Even though you offer up to me burnt offerings and your grain offerings, I won't accept them, for I will not even look at the peace offerings of your fatlings. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I won't even listen to the sounds of your harp. But let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream." If you want to be pleasing to me, show it. Don't just profess. It's not profession, but possession. Manifesting that. And the New Testament is very clear as well, the rest of the New Testament. Paul would say that these are people who held to a certain form of godliness, but they have denied its power. Avoid such men as these. In writing to Titus, his co-worker, he said, "They profess to know God, but by their deeds they deny him, being," he says, "detestable and disobedient and worthless for any good deed." So what he's saying is, look at their fruit. Look at what they're doing, not just what they're claiming. And so the scriptures are very strong then. When you are opposed to hypocrisy, you're agreeing with Jesus and the scriptures. This brings me to this second point here. We're saying then that Christ and the Bible clearly denounce it. And that thus that hypocrisy doesn't invalidate Christianity, but Christianity stands or falls on the person of Christ, not the performance of Christians. This is the thing that I want you to really grasp. The whole issue is really, in essence, these two points. Number one, when you hate hypocrisy, you're agreeing with Jesus. Secondly, that Christianity doesn't really depend for its authority and truth on the performance of Christians, but on the person of Jesus Christ. If it's true, it will work. But just because it works doesn't mean it's true. That's pragmatism. It has a genuine effect on people's lives, and if it's true, I would expect it to work. But the point is, the ultimate foundation for its truth is the founder, the one who is in fact alive, and about whom the whole relationship is built. And so everything depends on him. If Christ was a hypocrite, then everything crumbles into a heap. And it's interesting to me, the officers. You remember in John 7, the officers were sent out to arrest Jesus. And they were sent out by the chief priests and the Pharisees. But they returned empty-handed. And here's what they said in John 7:46. Never did a man speak the way this man speaks. They knew that there was an authenticity, a quality about him. There was a moral authority about him. That his words and his works were a seamless tunic. His life and his lips perfectly meshed. When I think of Jesus, he spoke of loving one another. And what did he do? He displayed unmatched compassion for the unlovable and the unlovely, did he not? He particularly sought out people that were rejected. For example, lepers, people who were blind, people who were poor, people who were outcasts. There were prostitutes. There were people who were rejected by their own people, the Samaritans. And he ministered to people that others would regard to be untouchable. So there was a consistency there. He spoke of servanthood. And he became the quintessential model for servanthood. He says, "You call me teacher and master, and so I am. Therefore, I command you to serve each other just as I have served you." Remember, having washed their feet? It was the essence of servanthood. Everything he did, I came to seek and to save. I came not to be served, but to serve and to give my life a ransom for many. All these things fit together. Absolute consistency between his words and his works. He claimed that he spoke of obedience to the will of his Father, and everything he did was in perfect conformity and submission to the life and purposes of God. Frankly, I submit that Jesus was the wisest and at the same time the humblest person who ever walked on the planet. And in his character, he perfectly realized the fruit of the Spirit. If you want to a mini-life of Jesus is the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. That's the life of Christ. If you want to see what Jesus was like, that's the essence of his life. And furthermore, his manifestation of truth. He spoke of truth and he lived the truth and asked, "Which of you convict me of any sin?" And no one could do so. Those who ate with him, who walked with him, who lived with him for 3.5 years, said, "In him there is no sin." So having said that then, the important point I want you to consider is this. When you then understand hypocrisy for what it really is, you're really agreeing with Jesus, then why let the people, the hypocrites that we do see, keep you from relationship with Jesus Christ? You see the point? Why let inconsistency in some of his followers keep you from him? Don't let that happen. It would be foolish. And no one ought to miss out on a relationship with Jesus because of someone else's inconsistency and hypocrisy. We are both the best argument for Christianity and the best argument against Christianity. I hate to say it. There's a sense in which Christians can be the best and the worst. And some of the things that we can see illustrate that ambivalence. But I want you to understand that ultimately it comes to deal with Christ. And ultimately, he himself said in Matthew 23:33, spoke about the religious hypocrites, that they would not escape the sentence of hell. Why plan to spend an eternity with them by rejecting Christ? Now, it's not a way I'd normally put it. But I would say that why let that be a barrier between you and Jesus? Focus on him. What do we see in the Scriptures? So the best thing I can do to this question is to invite a person to read the Gospels and to read them with a fresh eye and to look at the person of Jesus and to see, is this a person who is worth knowing? And is this a person who is consistent? Get them to focus on him and we're in the right direction. Questions? Yes.
A friend of mine answers that question. That if he could meet a man today who's like Christ, who followed him, that since there, he hasn't met anybody like that. How do you get around that?
I would say this, that there is nobody who is a perfect exemplar, a perfect incarnation. We are all flawed, but there still is a growing quality about true believers that I think illustrates a clear, distinguishable transformation process. And I will say as well that I have myself have met many Christians who evoke a certain spiritual authority and power in their very presence. I will sadly say that they're not as common as one would like to see, but they are there. Often these are people who've walked with Jesus for 30, 40, 50, 60 years. It takes time. It's a very slow process. I rather suspect that if people could live 300 years on this planet and walk with Jesus, you'd see a quality that'd be very hard to distinguish. But at the same time, if people who walk 300 years did not know Jesus, it'd be a scary thing, because they too would have moved in the other direction. That's why I suggest that even now you have a little intimation of heaven and hell. Just a little bit now. If it was 1,000 years, it'd be heaven and hell. Even on this planet, you begin to see that kind of difference. And so it would be. And what I guess I'm saying here is ultimately, I go back to the historical person of Jesus. He is the incarnation, the death, burial, the resurrection. These are palpable historical facts about a person who is alive now, whom I can follow. And I would claim that there are people, but, you know, obviously I can't prove it to this person if he claims he's never met someone like that. But what we'll see next week is that even someone like a Gandhi, him by his own admission, says, I have not attained the kind of the quality of spirituality that I myself have set out to attain. So he himself admitted his own failure. I hear Jesus saying, who of you convicts me of any sin? That I always do the things that are pleasing to my Heavenly Father. That's a pretty strong statement. And so what you have here is a radical difference. Have you ever played this thing where you imagine you were there when Jesus was there? I rather doubt that it would be as you imagine it. It wouldn't be quite as clear as you might suppose. And it's kind of scary what we might have done, because you had some reactions there. The more time you spent with people, the more they either hated him or loved him. It was an interesting, you never could be quite the same after the encounter. But people, here's the astounding thing in John 11 is the resurrection of Lazarus done right in front of the eyes of his enemies. And even then, they refused to bow the knee because they had so hardened their heart that all they wanted to do was kill Lazarus to get rid of the evidence. And then, of course, kill Jesus as well. I think that's an interesting illustration. I wonder how we would be if we were there, if it would be that clear, and we would. It's easy to have our 20/20 hindsight, but it's not so easy when you're there for that to occur. This is why many of these people really were disappointed in Jesus, terribly disappointed, because he wasn't the one they were looking for. They wanted somebody who would come, sort of like a Malachi 3:4 Messiah, one who'd come decisively. And to rule the planet and to change everything around and so forth. And they didn't see, nor would we have seen either in that fullness, that he was both the suffering servant and the reigning king, and that there would be a time in between those two. That would be something very, very different. You understand? So that's an issue, yeah.
You often find this objection raised and used as a cover for other objections.
Sure. Any of these objections that we look at can be smoke screens to avoid one's own need to encounter Jesus. My desire would be to get a person to the point where they are uncomfortable before the claims of Christ. When I say uncomfortable, I mean this, that they can no longer be indifferent. They can reject him. They can accept him, but to ignore them is no longer an option. Because my desire is to show a person that to ignore Jesus' claims is to reject him. You cannot be in neutral with Jesus. He forces a choice, and a lot of people don't want to make that choice. I myself tried to avoid it for 8 years. I just try to put it aside. And I did not want to accept or reject. I remember that very, very well. So I carefully tried to avoid ever thinking about these things for many years. So that can be a real problem. It's mostly has to do with being more concerned about impressing people than with pleasing God. I think a lot of it has to do with posturing because of our need for acceptance, security, significance. And so we want to project something that we're not to impress people. This is why so many of these people, the Pharisees of this time, wanted to go around, they lengthened the tassels and enlarged the phylacteries to look even more spiritual than they were. And they would take a lot of, actually they'd break their money down into small coins so that they could make the trumpet at the temple rattle and make a louder sound when they gave their alms. So everyone would notice, and they wanted to say their prayers in public and have the highest seats and, you know, all those things that he talks about. Frankly, we do it today. It's just we're maybe a little bit more discreet about it. It's easy to pick on the Pharisees, but they're still alive and well. And so there's any kind of attempt to appear to be what we're not. And we appear because appearance there is you're really appealing to human approval. A lot of it has to do with that, at least, for personal gain of one sort or another. I'll close in a prayer. Next week, again, we are going to look at, isn't a good moral life enough to get into heaven? Let me close in a prayer. Lord, we do thank you that the person of Christ is what we can focus on. But at the same time, Lord, I do pray that each of us would be in a process, an inside-out process of transformation. We desire that you would bring us more into conformity with him. And if there's anyone here who has not yet really come to know Christ, I pray that they would come to the point where they realize that it's to reject him or to accept him are the only options, and that they would accept him. And that is to say that they would put their trust and transfer their trust from themselves to him entirely and unreservedly, and bow the knee to him. We pray in his name. Amen.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.